Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, May 25, and our friends John Hulmer and Ray McGowan are back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
John, let's get started with you and the case of the talks that there. It seems that Russia is willing to talk with Ukrainians in Istanbul. And do you see the way that we've been witnessing that you Europeans, Merz and Starmer, together with Macron, they're trying to find the scene, on the scene to talk with Zelensky? How do you find the current situation? And do you think that we're going to get something in Istanbul?
Yes, we are. Let me try and answer your question by telling you or explaining what my Russian sources say is about to happen. And then we can go back and show how the Russians think they have outwitted the combination of Europeans and Zelensky. What's about to happen is this. The Russian side, President Putin, has agreed to make a deal with and for Trump. That's the first and basic point. Now, the question is, what exactly will be the deal that will be discussed in Istanbul? And will then Trump and Putin meet? When we talked last, I was expecting, because the Russians are expecting, a summit meeting between Putin and Trump. But that can't happen until and unless there is a simple agreement that would be initialed in Istanbul. So first thing, the Russian side has already delivered a paper indicating to President Trump and the US side what the main points are. I'll come to those in a minute. At the second step is that it's very unlikely that Putin will go to Istanbul and meet Zelensky, as Zelensky challenged after President Putin's very early Sunday morning meeting. If there's no agreement on the Russian paper that Trump endorses by the Ukrainian side, if there's no agreement, there'll be no summit meeting. So at that point, Trump would be prepared to walk away, and Russia will get on with the war and will go on advancing westward as it's been doing, as the spring offensive picks up momentum. I'm looking down at my notes just so that I get this right. The question that arises, two questions. One is, what would be the Russian terms? And this is being called the Kellogg trap in Moscow, or the Starmer trap, or the Macron trap, or the Merz trap. They have appeared to be saying negotiations first, sorry, ceasefire first, negotiations after, in that order. And that's what was agreed or said by, first by Kellogg and then by Zelensky in his last appearance, public appearance, which followed Putin's appearance. The Russians believe they have turned this around and that Trump agrees. It's negotiations first, then ceasefire. Ceasefire, as the Ukrainian side wanted, is nothing but a ceasefire. It's not what I'd call cease force. In other words, the basis for a long-term peace. And that's what President Putin called the press in 2 a.m. between Saturday and Sunday to announce. A very interesting, as it were, capping of what the Europeans thought they had done in Kiev on Saturday. Now, I disagree with a lot of folks, including my Russian friends, who think that Trump is adverse and against the Europeans, that the Europeans keep plotting with against Trump on Zelensky's behalf to keep the war going. I don't believe that to be the case. I think you could see that Macron deliberately tried to show, and subsequent to Kiev showed by little film clips he's tweeted, that he was coordinating with Trump. Trump said, and Macron said it in Kiev on Saturday, Trump has delivered a proposal to Zelensky. He's going to agree. That's a 30-day ceasefire. Trump was probably vague, as he always is. He wants the deal. He knows that Putin has agreed he'll get his deal, but the conditions are, first, in Istanbul, an agreement on a ceasefire must include stop of US deliveries of arms to the Ukraine. Cease force, as distinct from ceasefire, means no period of time for the Ukrainians to rearm, either rearm directly from the United States or Trump's new version of this, which is Trump supplies Patriot missile systems to Germany and Germany moves them on to the Ukraine. That's a no-go from a Russian point of view. So cease force is the Russian deal on the table in Istanbul. If there can be an initialing on that basis with some of the principles that were adopted in Istanbul 1 back in March 2022, demilitarization, neutrality, no NATO, and elections. This is another serious issue for the Russians. Zelensky's got to face elections because he's illegitimate. He's ruling by martial law, by presidential dicta. Ukraine, the Russian side will accept at this point and as we go forward an election that they believe will get rid of Zelensky. That would be a massive step towards the second goal of the special military operation, denazification. That's a Nazi, he's got to go. Now, the Russians are in no doubt that Merz, the new Chancellor of Germany, is a Nazi. Merz was there in Kiev. Merz was with Macron, and Merz has rejected President Putin's Sunday morning announcement. It's negotiations first, ceasefire second. But Merz doesn't count. Trump counts. So the Russian view is, at the moment, this is the way forward. This is what we are hoping and believe will happen in Istanbul. And if it goes according to our plan, Putin will meet Trump. Now, Trump has just a couple of hours ago, before he took off for Saudi Arabia, Trump said a number of very interesting points about what's about to happen. He said, rather than waste everybody's time in reading it, what he said a couple of hours back was, don't underestimate what will happen on Thursday in Turkey. I was thinking I might fly over there myself. If the deal gets done. Now, that's not quite what we predicted last time. I believed and said, because the Russian sources in a position to know had believed, that Putin was offering a summit with Trump in Abu Dhabi while he was in the United Arab Emirates, which is where he'll be 15th and the 16th. What subsequent happened since we spoke of that is Istanbul. So Trump has come up with the idea, maybe I'll fly to Istanbul, but the maybe hinges on all the other things happening and falling into place, as I've suggested.
Yeah. Ray, go ahead.
No, I want to thank John for bringing us up to date. If you need a job ever, John, I think the president's daily brief, you'd be a really good briefer.
He doesn't have a daily briefing. He has a once a week briefing, subordinate to lunching with Vance. I wouldn't mind cooking for those two.
Well, that's the rhetoric. I dare say I think he's getting briefed by Tulsi Gabbard more often than once a week. But be that as it may, you know, I think that the role that the coalition of the, they call themselves the willing, a good friend of mine, Oliver Boyd Barrett, calls them the coalition of the brain dead. I'm talking about Starmer and Macron and Maltz and now Tusk, brain dead. And I think that gradually Zelensky is beginning to see that all their puffery and all their beating of their chest really will not amount to anything when push comes to shove. Now, I was just in Vnukovo Airport when Putin, flying back to the States, when Putin said to the media, wait a second, don't go yet. No, don't rush out. We've got a new initiative from the brain dead. No, he didn't say the brain dead, from these four. And I want to reply to it. So they all gathered at 2 o'clock in the morning and he issued that incredibly clever little statement saying, okay, look, you know, we've never been against negotiations. Sure, we're willing to do that. That would be a really good idea. The fly in the ointment, of course, is Putin is he's trained in the law. Whatever you think of his actions, he tries to have a legal framework about it. And for Putin, as he said in more polite terms, Zelensky is a bastard. I mean, like, he's not legal. He's illegitimate, I guess is what I'm trying to say here. And so that was a law passed by the Rada in 2022. So I think at very least, Putin will have to say, well, look, you know, I told you I'm not going to meet with you at all. And you, that was part of the thing that you decided you never, I think the wording was, we'll never authorize the Rada, we'll never authorize the president of Ukraine to meet with the leader of Russia as long as it's still Putin. You know, so here's Putin's going to, through Lavrov, I guess, say, all right, now you change the law first. That will be a sticky wicket. They could change the law. Most people expect them to do that or just regard the law, which the Ukrainians regularly do. So let's say that Zelensky sends his Arakhamia, his best friend, the head of his faction in the Rada, who was the principal negotiator in 2022, March and April. They started in Belarus. They ended up in Istanbul. They came to an agreement. So the symbolism here of Istanbul is really, really striking. They want to go back to Istanbul. They want to go back to those agreements, which were initialed, and we have the text now of some of them. What happened, of course, we know. And it's not just McGovern saying this, or Helmer, or you, Nima. We know it's on the record. Arakhamia came back to Kiev and said, you know, we had that damn thing all set to go. And Boris Johnson came in on the 9th of April and said, no, you can't do that. This is not about, we're going to support you for as long as it takes, but not if you sign that thing. The idea is this is where we're going to weaken Russia. So Zelensky, also under pressure from the neo-Nazis in his regime, and then Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister of Israel, was in on making these deals. And he swears it was a done deal when Boris Johnson came in. So what the Russians are saying is, yeah, let's not start from scratch. Let's go back to Istanbul. dig out those agreements. Remember, they were actually initialed. Maybe Arachamia will be the guy to go back there. I hope so. He seems to have a level head, and he's very honest in how he divulged the role of Boris Johnson and everything else, how it went down. So I see good hope here, and I see with Trump's endorsement that he's trying to tell Zelensky, look, you can play around with the coalition of the brain dead if you want, all right? You've been playing around with it for months now. What's it gotten you? Do they have the money? Do they have the arms? Look, make the deal. So John rightly points out the devil is in the details, but I think this will be a good step forward, the more so since I think Trump has finally put his foot down and said, look, we've got a reasonable chance of reaching an agreement. Zelensky, you better make this happen. You better not go yourself. Send somebody else. Maybe Arachamia. That's how I see it. Do you agree, John?
Yes and no, Ray. I mean, I agree your overall conclusion. I agree that the Putin side has agreed to give Trump a deal, and that encourages Trump to go for the deal the Russians are offering, because the alternative is no deal, he walks away. He isn't going to walk away. He's arming the war through Germany, through various other, the French and the British and so on. But if there's a stop to deliveries as part of this deal, we've got a new situation. And that was one of the problems with Istanbul 1. It's all very well for the Ukrainian side or for anyone else to say that Boris Johnson or Joe Biden blocked it. That was only half the story. In Moscow, the terms that have been initialed by Vladimir Medinsky at the prompting of Roman Abramovich were not acceptable to the general staff and were not acceptable to the intelligence services and were not politically acceptable inside Russia. Why? For the reason that President Putin came out on Sunday morning to explain. I've got to read it to you. It's possible, said Putin, to agree on some kind of new truce and new ceasefire, but a real ceasefire, there's a difference. That would be observed not only by Russia, but also by the Ukrainian side, and would be the first step, I repeat, towards a long-term sustainable peace rather than a prelude to continuing armed conflict after the Ukrainian armed forces have been rearmed, re-equipped, and frantically dig trenches and new strongholds. Who needs such a peace? Now, that's what Putin said on Sunday morning at 2 o'clock, but it wasn't in Istanbul 1. And the Russian side said to the president, what's been initialed falls short of what we've gone to war or gone to the special military operations, distinct from the war, for that purpose. What President Putin is now saying is, I learned the lesson from that round. There must be an end to rearming. A ceasefire isn't just going to be a pause. That's not acceptable.
No, I agree. I agree, John.
Yeah. Here is what Donald Trump said about the talks in Istanbul.
Insisted that that meeting take place. And it is taking place. And I think you may have a good result out of the Thursday meeting in Turkey between Russia and Ukraine. And I believe the two leaders were going to be there. I was thinking about flying over. I don't know where I'm going to be on Thursday. I've got so many meetings. But I was thinking about actually flying over there. There's a possibility of it, I guess, if I think things can happen. But we got to get it done. We got to save 5,000 lives a week. 5,000 lives is really more than that. It's worse than that. And when you see the...
Wait, it seems that Donald Trump is somehow optimistic about the talks in Istanbul. He said, I may fly to Istanbul. Do you think that he knows something that we are not aware of?
No, I think I just tried to explain it. The reason he's optimistic is that he understands what Putin has told him privately. And he's looked, he may not have looked at the term paper that the Russians put, but he understands that Putin is ready and has decided to give him a deal. The job is to make sure that the term paper that's initialed in Istanbul at a lower level, Zelensky's trapped himself. Zelensky said, I'm going to go to Istanbul personally. Well, Putin won't be there. So Zelensky's there by himself with his mates, maybe Yermak, maybe Arakhamov, maybe a whole gaggle of them. But in it, or maybe he pulls out and lets them go forward. But either way, Trump's confidence expressed there, and he was unusually, for him, lucid on the point, is because he knows Putin has agreed a deal. The devil in the details, he doesn't really care about yet. When he says, I've got a lot of meetings, yes, he's going to a theme park in Saudi Arabia out of Riyadh on Tuesday for a break, and then he'll move on. He's got a lot, I mean, he's got a lot on his mind, but not details. And so there's a crucial crunch coming in Istanbul. And we just, as I've read it, has Putin's made it clear, it cease force, not just cease fire. Now, the Russian press over today have celebrated that Putin beat the Europeans and Zelensky out of the trap they'd set. I disagree with that, but it's understandable that they would feel victorious in this tactical way, because it was an extremely clever move on Sunday morning to do that to the Europeans. I mean, what we've seen in France, what we've seen on the internet, there it is. Macron was snorting coke on the train going into Kiev. The French are also circulating that there was a line of coke and a little piece of white paper in Kiev itself, and that Merz was fully involved. So you have two cokeheads in Kiev. Wow, is this something? It's a bit irrelevant to the underlying reality from a Russian point of view that there's a consensus. This won't be the mistake the domestic reaction was after Istanbul won, after Medinsky came back with this initial document. This is a cease force agreement, and they think, and I think, there's the reason to hope that Ray indicated that Putin and Trump will see it happen.
Yeah, Ray, go ahead.
No, I don't have much to add to that. I was thinking about the pause that refreshes. Isn't that having coke? You know, looking at these, the coalition of the brain dead. Well, the coke is part of it. Starmer is about to be replaced in the UK, as far as I can tell. Who's the other guy? Mouts? My God, when the Russians look at Mouts, they see revanchism. I mean, they see a guy who's an unredeemed, Nazi or neo-Nazi. And they don't see much hope that the German populace can restrain this guy. So as long as Trump has put in to Putin the notion that, all right, this comes out well, we will stop providing arms to Ukraine. There's no more money for it anyway, and I'm not going to ask Congress for any more. And we won't give them any money, more money, period. And if that's part of the deal, then Zelensky's either got to fly off to one of his palaces somewhere abroad, or he's got to kind of negotiate some more. And he has some good people. Now, this Arakhamiya impresses me as somebody who's not brain dead, who did the best he can and was really, really angry when Boris Johnson shows up on the 9th of April, 2022, and says, no, you're not going to do that. Fight on. We will support you as long as it takes. That's what the phrase was, right? Well, it's as long as it takes now. The proof is in the pudding. I can't wait until Thursday to see how this comes out. If indeed it eventuates at all.
John, you see, the main barrier is still, do you think, is still Donald Trump? And you've mentioned that Donald Trump doesn't care about the details. That could be a big problem if he himself is running the show. He himself is talking with Witkoff. But that is that going to bring difficulties to the negotiation? Is that going to be a point of a positive point that he said that he's going to, when he says he's going to go to Istanbul, he expects Vladimir Putin to be there. You've mentioned that Putin is not going to go there.
No, they will meet. The understanding, let's put it this way, it sounds a bit contorted. The understanding I have of the Russian understanding is that there's an understanding between Putin and Trump, that if enough of the Russian concerns, let's call them, are initialed on the term sheet in Istanbul, one, a ceasefire that the Russians are ready to grant more or less in place in exchange for the stopping of arms supplies to the Ukraine. And bear in mind, Trump is allowing 120 odd patriots to be shipped right now, from now on, according to the New York Times and everybody else. That was a Biden deal, but Trump is honoring it. Remember, there was a Trump pause back in February whilst renewed the deliveries. The deliveries must stop. Equally, there'll be something said about intelligence sharing, which is the way in which the United States and the NATO allies enable the Ukrainians to attack Russia by drone or by missile, by artillery in real time. That's got to stop too. But if you've got a ceasefire and the Ukrainians are honoring it, targeting is a lesser priority, because that's a real-time combat issue, a very sore one, but that's a lesser priority than the issue of that Putin made. A peace without that enables the other side to rearm, resupply, refortify, that's not a real peace. It's not going to go. If it's not agreed in principle, if the Ukrainian side reject it, with or without Starmer, Macron, and Merz, then Putin doesn't go, Trump doesn't go, they don't meet. Now,
one thing I'd add here is that, as most people know, Putin is in no hurry, okay? He seems supremely confident, you know? He even acknowledged about 2 weeks ago that some people want me to go real fast, much faster here. Some people want me to go right to the Dnieper. Why? You know, we got the upper hand here. We're in no rush. So that's to be borne in mind. And Trump is a transactional guy. I hope that his intelligence advisors are telling him, look, Putin has won the war. He's willing to settle on terms that will put lipstick on a pig. Take advantage of it, lean on the Ukrainians, and see what you can do. If they don't, you know, if you continue to let the Ukrainians, you as their curators, you continue to let them run wild, well, we'll just go and go and go, and then you'll have even less to bargain with, because we'll be on the Dnieper River, and then that situation will be a little more difficult. One thing I keep coming back to is that Putin 2 years ago put up a straw in the wind, Odessa, he said, a beautiful city, Catherine the Great, Odessa, a Russian city. Now, is he going to want to attack Odessa? Is he going to want to subdue Odessa and kill most Russian-speaking people? I don't think so. I think there's a deal there. The more so, since this is sensible from the Ukrainian perspective. If they don't have access to the Black Sea, they are not a nation. They're a farm for the rest of Europe. So I see leverage there, and not leverage. I see an opening that 2 years ago, nobody noticed, but in one of these long Q&As, he was asked this question. And so, you know, as far as Odessa and Dnipropetrovsk or Kharkiv, as long as they are not subdued, well, there's reason to think that Putin doesn't want to attack them. And he could offer these as a kind of a city, Odessa, for example, that would be run in an international way, like Trieste was back after World War I. So there are all kinds of possibilities here. I think Putin and Trump are really out pretty far now in saying they're going to have this deal. And I just hope that they're smart enough to do this, because after all, Trump has other equities that he has to protect, what he sees as his equities in genocide, for God's sake, and against China. So I think that there's lots on Trump's plate. He wants to get rid of Ukraine, the Ukraine deal. And that's another background type explanation as to why he really wants to move, even though he does not have to.
I think that this issue of Odessa is misrepresented in the U.S. press. I mean, Kellogg has claimed that that Ukraine's winning the war because Russia hasn't taken Odessa, hasn't crossed the Dnieper River. What else? And didn't take Kiev. Well, none of those three targets were not on the objectives of the special military operation, and Russia's not armed and equipped and ready and prepared to do any of those things. I entirely agree with Ray that the long-term future for Odessa, as all Russians know, is Odessa will always go on with the winning side and where the money is. It's all very well to celebrate the Russian culture of Odessa. We all know that. But the fact is that Russians don't like Odessans. They go there and they have their pockets picked. My wife has experienced that the sea is polluted beyond belief, etc., etc. You want to have a holiday at the beach, you go to Crimea, you don't go to Odessa. In the medium term, Odessa will go with the money. The money will be Russian. But the condition I mentioned is there has to be a new election and Zelensky has to be removed. Without that, you've got a neo-Nazi president around a basically Lvov gang who have inflicted on Odessa all manner of purges, not to mention the murders of the at the Union House murders back in 2022. Kharkov, and there's to be no city fighting. That was clearly a Russian view. And the offensive that moves slowly is partly moving to conserve Russian lives, and partly because Russian military organization is not quite as terrific as those who triumphantly say it is. There's a lot to be done to reform and improve and reconstruct the Russian military to face the longer term NATO enemies. And in that longer term prospect, Russia needs time. We agree, we need time, but Russia has to recover from the failures since 2014 to stop NATO fortification of the Ukraine so it could fight as it's been doing. Mm-hmm. That's a very serious military problem, and Russia can't solve it simply by rushing towards Kiev. They can't. Equally, there was no defeat of the line of Russian armor outside Kiev in 2022. They withdrew. They were parked there against a political settlement that failed, a political putsch in March 2022 that didn't happen because there was a disastrous battle of Antonov Airport. The entire, as it were, limited military political military putsch plan of late February, early March failed. And it failed for Russian miscalculation. And there are plenty of Russians who'll say it publicly. It's not just me. So some terrible, costly lessons have been learned. In addition, President Putin has restricted the capabilities of the Russian side to complete the electric war campaign. What I've called the electric war campaign is the attacks on the electricity generating infrastructure. Without electricity, trains don't go, toilets don't flush, armies don't get resupplied. The Kursk attack cannot have been assembled without electricity. Now, there was a mistake. We won't have time to go into why it was mistaken to put restrictions on electric war campaign. It could have been done. It wasn't done. It was delayed. It was sequenced. Now we are in a new world in which President Putin is saying, I've learned my lessons. This is, and now we've got to teach the Americans to learn their lessons. And Trump is saying, sort of similarly, we're going to have a war sequence. We're not going to fight a war in Europe at the same time as we've got a higher priority war with China. So we've talked about that before. Russian strategy sequencing with time. US strategy is sequencing war with time. Russian strategy is sequencing, hopefully, peace, but preparing for war in time.
Yeah. Let me go back and say, John, this is really helpful background for people who haven't followed this as closely as I've had to try to follow it, and you have. If you go back to the day after the special military operation began, you don't know this yet, but we know from watching the media and other things that Zelensky said, oh my God, this can't be. I have a negotiator here. I'd like to send them to Belarus. Let's get talk started, yeah. Okay? Now, the media in the United States talks about not only unprovoked, but full-scale operation, full-scale, but with 90,000 troops? I don't think. What was the operation about pushing toward Kiev? The operation was about scaring the daylights out of Zelensky. And it worked, okay? So they had these negotiations prior to Istanbul. Then they moved them to Istanbul, and they came up with a deal. And what happened? Well, Boris Johnson came in, as we know, but also there was the that terrible massacre that everybody advertised at Bucha, okay? It was all done by British intelligence and the Ukrainian intelligence people. The Russians were accused of mass massacre of the people there in the city of Bucha. So that happened, you know, right after that. So that was what we can't deal with these people. So what I'm saying here is that that thing was derailed. It can easily be put back on the tracks, and you can use the same. I do hope that Arakhamiya, whatever his name is one of the leaders of the Kiev group. There is a mutual incentive to settle this thing, and the notion that the Russians wanted to do a full-scale invasion. They must be crazy if they thought they could do this with 90,000 troops. And as John has already said, their objective was not to take Kiev. Now, that's the real story. Now, actually, it was Trump a couple of terms ago that talked about alternative facts. Okay, I never knew there were such a thing as alternative facts. Well, Joe Biden was interviewed by BBC. I just happened to see it earlier today. He was asked, now, Mr. President, a lot of people are saying that there can be no deal unless Ukraine is willing to give up territory that the Russians have already conquered. Do you think this is right, or do you think it's appeasement? And the former president, thank God, Biden said, oh, it's new appeasement, he said. Now, listen to this. Biden, when Putin announced that he was going to from Kiev. He was going to come and he was going to attack the rest of Ukraine. When he announced that, he was going to go not only to the rest of Ukraine, but why? Well, number one, because he can't stand the fact, says Biden, that the Soviet Union fell apart. And he's not gonna stand for that. And besides, listen to what it's a modern day appeasement. He can't stand for that. And you think this is at the key here. I wish I could read my scribbling. He says, you think Putin's gonna stop that after he was in Kiev, says Biden, and then he came down. And then you think he should have stopped with Ukraine? No way is he going to stop with Ukraine. Now, my God, this is the former president. Now, the good news is that this person, Avril Haines, a political hack from the word go, who told Biden in December of 2022 that the Russians were running out of ammunition, that they had no indigenous capability to build more ammunition, that Russia and China they'll have meetings, doesn't mean anything. This idiot is no longer there. You have a very smart person there now, Tulsi Gabbard. So I think one of the reasons that this is easier for Trump is he's getting good advice. And I think, well, he's saying, I mean, this is the key. He said, you know, when I look at Ukraine and Russia, I can see where the Russians wouldn't want to have a heavily armed NATO member right on their long. I can understand that. Well, my God, that's 75% of the problem. Okay, so he could understand why they shouldn't be in NATO, and he said so. The rest is in the details, but there are lots of people in Washington and in Moscow, actually, that want to put the kibosh on this detente or thaw. And one of the big uplifts for me being in Moscow for the last 2 weeks was that the last time I was there, there was a great prospect of detente, of rapprochement. It was the ABM treaty that was signed in May of 1972. I was elated, you know. I was one of those guys that had to hide under my desk as a child. I was just walking on air as I left that, because we were able to play a role. Doverai no proverai, trust but verify. When Kissinger and Nixon asked us, you know, with the Russian cheat, Soviet cheat, we said, don't know. How soon can you tell us? Well, we went back to the guys that run the satellites and all that stuff. We said, probably a week or 10 days. Okay, that's enough. If you can doverai, we will doverai. And there's more than just the ABM treaty signed there. It was an incredible fillip to detente. So why am I saying all this? Because here I am back 53 years later, okay? And I'm seeing the same kind of hope coming about. And the celebration of the 80th victory over the Nazis seemed to be so meaningful that I was just delighted to have a ringside seat at the parade and so forth, thanks to Oliver Stone. I was in his entourage, and that meant something. So there's great hope in my view. And, you know, whether it's that Trump wants to go on and start other wars or continue genocide support or whatever, as far as Ukraine is concerned, you know, the Jekyll and Hyde thing here, I applaud what he's trying to do in with respect to Ukraine. I think Putin has said that he's worthy of trust. And after all the betrayals that Putin has suffered in his 21-year tenure from betrayals from 25-year, whatever it is, from 2000, so for him to talk about trust, for him to say that he thinks that that Mr. Trump is sincere, well, that shows me that he's either very foolhardy or he's perspicacious and thinks he's got the upper hand. He's got the general staff convinced that he knows what he's doing and this will come out all right. I know, John, you may have a different view with respect to the general staff.
John, do you have?
Yes. but it, I don't think we need to repeat it because we've gone over it. The history of the empire to try to destroy Russia is a very long history. It's gone through different episodes since 1945, and we have seen different episodes of the way in which the US empire in Europe has sought to neutralize or destroy the capabilities of Russia, as in the Soviet Union form or in the present form, to redevelop itself in partnership with Germany, with Europe, and with the United States. But for Russians, do not underestimate that the US, underlying US goal was to destroy Russia in 1917, and it was became the Russian fixation during Stalin period, when he tried to protect Russia from the Hitler threat, and was and faced a US support for Hitler. I mean, we can go on and on. I don't think it's useful to retell the history, except that Russians don't forget the history, nor do I, nor does Ray. To be hopeful now is tactical. For when President Putin says he can trust Trump, that's relative to Biden. It's a relative statement, and it's a political statement, and it's a statement of prospect for negotiation. It's not a denial of the underlying commitment of the United States and its empire or protectorate of Europe, which President Trump has no intention whatever of giving up. He's simply sequencing his wars and allocating his scarce means. And next is China, which we'll come to in a minute, because it's been tested in India and Pakistan over the last week. But I see President Putin's trust in Trump to be simply a case of requires to be verified. But underlying that, President Putin was trained in a Soviet school. His family suffered from the advance of the German threat, initially backed by the Americans. The United States, let's say, perversion of care for Russia through the Yeltsin period was a perversion, and President Putin is very clear about that, and so is every Russian person. It was perverse. It destroyed Russia's standard of living, and right now, during President Putin's term to now, Russians have recovered. But I don't think it's fair to say that hope is more than tactical. It's not. It's not religious. It's not a faith. Yes, there are always going to be factions in Russian politics who want to be loved by the Americans or by any foreigner with whom they can make business, or even professors who get, you know, happy seats at the Wilson Center or at Harvard or somewhere else. There's always, and the intelligentsia was always split between those who wanted to go to Oxford or go to Harvard or go to Princeton, and those who would make their careers at home. That's normal, normal self-interested political and economic advancement. There will always be a pro-American faction in Russian politics, but it does not lead the country as Boris Yeltsin did and represented, and it does not lead the country now.
And that was a catastrophe, and I would underline Yeltsin. Here are some World Bank figures. From 1991 to 1995, the average age at which a Russian male died went from 73 to 67. 5 years. There are a lot of people still alive in Russia that remember that. So there's lots of doubts about whether the U.S. or anybody else could be trusted. Gorbachev, of course, is ridiculed in Russia now, although when I shook his hand several years ago, I didn't wash my hand for a long time. He's a hero in my view, but he trusted the Americans. On the other hand, the Russians also have this this history going back well before these current times. When they finally got their act together after the Tatarskaya Iga, the Tatar yoke from 1200 to 1440, for God's sake, more than two. When they finally got their act together, and Ivan the Third and the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible, they got the boyars and the nobles to come together. They had a Muscovy. Okay, what happened? The Swedes came in, and the Poles, and the Lithuanians, and the Hanseatic League, the Germans came and sliced up Russia again until they were knocked out. Now, every school child knows that history. I talked to several of them at this youth forum. They are educated in a way that we don't see very, very much evidence of here. So bottom line for me is Peter the Great came in, okay? He was after Moscow and Petersburg had consolidated. And he said, we're gonna smash, his word, prorubit okno, into Europe. He's going to smash a window into Western Europe. That's our future, Russia. Well, that's completely changed now. He's open to these coalition of the, what do I call them, the Dumkopfs, okay? But he's not going to play with them anymore. Everything has, he's beat a window to the east with China, India, with the Shanghai group, with the BRICS. And that's a tectonic shift in the correlation of forces, to use an old Soviet expression. That's the background of all this. And against that background, I think that Trump is willing to play a sensible game. We'll just see how much grief the Europeans and Zelensky himself are prepared to give him, lest he succeed in getting kind of a deal that the Russians can accept. And there's no deal the Russians will accept without them meeting their two criteria, denazification as well as demilitarization. The latter has already happened.
John, with the case of India and Pakistan,
what's really important to understand is the very significant change in the correlation of forces that has just happened over the last 10 days as India retaliated from Pakistan's terrorist attack. And we talked about it last week, but let's go to the strategic crunch that has now occurred. I'm basing what I have to say on my Indian sources and colleagues, as well as my long ago familiarity with Pakistani politics, internal politics, and the role the army plays and the oligarchs play in Pakistani governance. What has happened, in my view, is that India has achieved a complete change in the capacity of China to support Pakistan militarily or economically. The Indian success has occurred notwithstanding the Western press view that Chinese weapons were significantly victorious on the battlefield. This is incorrect. It's false. What happened was, and the damage assessments will continue over the next 2 or 3 weeks. And I've put on my website access for listeners who are interested to listen to the Indian military briefing of what exactly happened. But let me summarize from my independent view, from the way the Russians are reporting it. At least 2 Indian aircraft were shot down, but probably by Chinese-made air-to-air missiles. Both the dogfights occurred uniquely more than 100 kilometers apart. I'm putting my hands out beyond the screen here because no aircraft on the Pakistani side penetrated the Indian border and no Indian aircraft penetrated the Pakistani border. These were unusual aerial dogfights of a kind that's rare, and they occurred. The Chinese-made fighters did inflict a limited damage and shot down between two, acknowledged on the Indian side, or five, claimed by the Chinese and Pakistani side, aircraft. However, that's small beer, to make a wrong metaphor, compared to the damage India was able to inflict its air force, its missile force, its drone force on every functioning anti-aircraft system in Pakistan, and that's Chinese made. So what has happened is dramatic. China supplies more than 70% of Pakistan's weaponry, and its anti-aircraft systems were taken out, destroyed by Indian attack. That meant that Pakistan was naked to air attack that didn't follow. The Indians didn't need to do that. What they did do was respond to a Pakistani attack on Indian air bases, which did minimal damage at significant losses for the attackers. What the Indians then did was to attack 11 Pakistani air bases, including Sargodha, which is the base that stocks India's nuclear warheads. What the Indians then say they did was to use this military demonstration to teach the adversary what one of the Air Force Marshal in the briefing called good wisdom about not fighting on. What in fact happened was that after the Indians destroyed the anti-aircraft defenses, what then happened is when they penetrated the air bases was that Pakistan telephoned the United States, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, and asked for mediation. The Russians had refused to mediate, and as both parties were interested, India was never interested in mediating. And what the Indians told Rubio was, this is not to be negotiated at a political level. It'll be negotiated between the military commanders on each side. And that's what happened. A ceasefire was organized, and that's in place for the moment. There were some violations in the first few hours, but it's holding for the time being. What isn't holding for the time being is the destruction of the reputation of Chinese arms to defend an ally. And that's the most serious outcome, strategically speaking, which the Indians are, let's say, celebrating. Because for their point of view, China is their principal enemy. What they now view to be the future situation are two things. The Pakistan platform, a war platform against them, as the Ukraine is a war platform of NATO against Russia. The platform of war against India on the part of Pakistan is finished. What India will now do in the long term is seek to dismantle the state in not dissimilar way to the way in which the Hungarians, the Poles, and others view the future of the Ukraine. That's what the Indians are politically saying, what they say militarily. In that future, China will have to reassess its long-term interest, for example, in Balochistan, which is arguably going to go independent. Gilgit, as we go up in the north of Pakistan, and what used to be the northwest frontier provinces on the Afghan border. All of this is about to change because Pakistan's army, from an international warfighting point of view, is kaput. But more important from the internal domestic point of view, the Pakistan army shows it doesn't deserve to rule the country any longer because it can't defend the country any longer. And this is far worse in domestic Pakistani politics than Pakistan's defeat that in the 71 when Bangladesh was formed, when Eastern Pakistan was lost and became independent. A similar process now is underway in the West. And that may very well change the way Iran, China, the United States, and Russia view the future of Pakistan and that region. This is very big, and it has implications for China's relationships with both Russia and the United States and India. It has very big implications for Russia's relationship with China, because Russian arms succeeded on the Indian side. The S-400 Russian-supplied anti-aircraft system was effective in interception, and it survived all attempts to attack it. In addition, the most effective Indian missile, the BrahMos, is a joint venture. Bra, the Indian side, Mos, the machine astroids, I've forgotten what it's, astroids Venya, the machine construction branch of the Russian armaments industry. That between the two of them, the BrahMos is a joint Indian-Russian missile, and it succeeded. It succeeded. So Chinese arms have failed in this little war. Russian arms have succeeded. That's a very big message strategically. Now, if you look at it from Trump's point of view, sequencing away from Europe, to concentrating on a war with China, Trump is cock-a-hoop, because the Indians have done to the Chinese what he was planning to do in a few years' time. Second, he might calculate, and the brains behind him, Wes Mitchell and Eldridge Colby. These upper class U.S. names, first names I never get straight. The military capacity of China to resist U.S. pressure has just demonstrably weakened. So what we will see, I expect, is an increased, pardon me, pressure by the U.S. to test China in as many weak points as the U.S. has already been looking for, and the Indians just showed them. And that's a very significant problem, which Russia can help China deal with.
Let me just comment, John. That's a really interesting briefing. I had not known many of those details. I think it's a little bit exaggerated to say that China has been shown to be weakened here. What interests me most is that both countries, Pakistan and India, being nuclear armed countries, that there was a deterrent introduced here. And if I believe the Western press, Trump played some sort of major role in that. Now, you mentioned that the Indians called Rubio. Is it correct?
The Pakistanis called Rubio.
I misunderstood that. All right. Yeah. Is it correct that Trump played a major role here? Because the last time this happened, 23, 24 years ago, my God, Larry Wilkerson, my good friend, he was chief of staff to Powell. They flew off to Pakistan and Indians. Oh, my God, stop it, stop it. Now, this time it was stopped. I'm interested in how much of a role Rubio or Trump himself played in preventing further escalation. Do you have any views on that?
I'd rather not. I mean, my personal views got to be subordinate to to what my sources are saying. Mm-hmm. The Indians are showing a very similar level of respect for Trump as President Putin, the Kremlin, and the Russian side are showing. So there's no bad-mouthing Trump's claim to have achieved more than in fact he did. Essentially, you're right to refer to the nuclear deterrent. The Indian strategy from before this began was escalation dominance, escalation control. Make it clear to the Pakistanis that they wouldn't get to the nuclear stage before they would lose control of their own defense and their own attack capabilities. By hitting Sargodha, the Indians were able to show you won't even be able to reach for that weapon. Mm. We are going to limit escalation. And everything that the Indian military generals have said in briefing, yes, they're the victors, and yes, they're writing the history of the win from the victor's point of view, is escalation control and a refocus away from military now to economic control of Pakistan's water, for example, the control of its ability to control Balochistan, Gilgit, and the regions, and encourage the Pakistani people to do what they haven't been able to achieve all these years, liberation from the army and the oligarch families that have run the country with the army all these years. So in that role, Indian military force played a decisive role to the point where Pakistan had to apply to the only power left to mediate, which wasn't China. But China was assisting in the defense. Mm-hmm. It had to be the United States. And the U.S. Encouraged India not to go further. And a success is now being argued about. For example, you'll hear arguments in India among the generals and in the social media and in the press, why didn't we go 48 hours more operations and destroy more of their military capability? Kind of like the line the Israelis took when they destroyed every Syrian military position they could find during the interval when Turkey took over Damascus through Mr. Shara. So the U.S. role was to get the Indians to stop when they stopped. But it was in an Indian interest, not a U.S. interest, to stop then, because they had demonstrated all they needed to demonstrate, the limited cost of Indian lives and the limited cost of Indian treasure. And that's what they're celebrating now. And from their point of view, they achieved the tactical military objective and the strategic political one. The strategic political one is neutralize China on that war platform, so as to remind them, you won't do any better in the Himalayas.
Yeah. That was interesting, John. Your take. What I was hearing from the news that I'm getting was totally the opposite way that you.
Well, there's always a possibility I'm wrong, but I'm reflecting, yes, an Indian view of what's just happened. And I tried to answer Ray's view. It'll be a US view pretty soon that China has been made a lot more vulnerable, but that'll come out soon. On the other hand, I spent many happy years in Pakistani politics. I used to write for Viewpoint of Lahore, a wonderful and politically sophisticated publication by Mazhar Ali Khan. Now he's dead and the magazine's dead, but it was the growth point for independent Pakistani journalism, which was opposed to the oligarch families, including the Bhutto family, I might say, and opposed to the military rule, which in those times, my time, was Zia al-Huq. The prospect of, let's call it, democratic evolution in Pakistan is now greater. Not at the point of an Indian bayonet, but at the point at which Pakistani political forces say the armies are fake, the army is repressive, the armies are cost, the army won't even keep West Pakistan together, and they can't protect us from what the Indians could do now. So there have to be changes. And that's progressive. As painful as it is now for Pakistanis to face this now, it's progressive for them in the long term, because the two dominant repressive forces, the army and the oligarchs, have been shown to be paper tigers.
Do you have something to add?
No, I think that wraps it up. It exhausts my knowledge about this complex problem.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ray and John, for being with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
I wanted to talk about Iran as well, but we are running out of time. Yeah. Thank you, by the way. Mm-hmm. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Take care, John. Take care, Nima.
Thanks.